From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A look at partisan bloodletting on Capitol Hill. Then we go to Northern Ireland to speak with human rights activist Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey about the arrest of her daughter. Also, a controversy erupts in Britain over Some Mother's Son, a new film that looks back at the IRA hunger strikers.
I've got a lawyer downstairs, and he says that he could get your charge reduced to conspiracy.
I have to tell you something. I'm probably going to get locked up for a long time. And I don't need a lawyer. Because I'm a prisoner of war. I am not a criminal. I don't recognize the court.
Are you out of your mind?
No, I'm not out of my mind.
Time's up.
No, I haven't
Time's
finished
up.
Yet.
I'll be all right.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Benjamin Begin, a chief ideologue of the Israeli right and son of the late Prime Minister Menachem Begin, resigned from his cabinet post today in protest against Israel's agreement to cede West Bank lands to the PLO. Meanwhile, debate continues in both the Israeli parliament and the Palestinian Legislative Council. And in heavy rain and fog, Israeli soldiers loaded up dozens of trucks with boxes and equipment and lowered the Star of David flag today in the beginning of the end of their 30-year rule in Hebron. General Motors Corporation has chosen Raytheon Company to buy its Hughes Electronics Defense Division for $9.5 billion, a move that would create one of the largest defense contractors in the country. Raytheon, based in Lexington, Massachusetts, manufactures missiles, radar, and air traffic. Last week, it acquired the defense electronic business of Texas Instruments for $3 billion. A Raytheon-Hughes Electronics merger would create the third largest defense contractor in the nation behind the Boeing Company and Lockheed Martin Corporation. U.S. companies could begin selling high-performance aircraft and other advanced weapons to Latin America under a compromise proposal sent to President Clinton by his departing secretaries of state and defense. Relaxing a ban on such sales had been advocated by Secretary of Defense William Perry, but opposed by Secretary of State Warren Christopher. The Justice Department is investigating a proposal to put Coke machines in the lobbies of 40,000 post offices. The problem, according to the Washington Post, is that Postmaster General Marvin Runyon owns more than $50,000 worth of Coke stock and that he personally got involved in the discussions. This news from Oakland. The school board has revised its policy recognizing Black English as a separate language, hoping to mollify critics who feared the wording implied students would be taught in Ebonics. The revisions, approved late yesterday, drop any suggestion that Ebonics, a combination of ebony and phonics, is genetically based, and cut wording that implies students would be taught in both Ebonics and Standard English. And today is the deadline for House Ethics Committee Special Counsel James Cole to complete his final report in the case against Speaker Newt Gingrich. Cole has spent more than a year investigating Gingrich, in particular the funding of a college course Gingrich taught at two Georgia campuses. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The House Ethics Committee investigation into Gingrich's violations of House rules was supposed to culminate this week in nationally televised public hearings. Instead, it's a senior Democrat, Washington Congressmember Jim McDermott, that is facing an FBI investigation. But all of this heat is nothing new. Congress has survived more turbulent turf wars. In 1832, Congressmember Sam Houston of Tennessee attacked Congressmember William Stanbury of Ohio, who quickly brandished his gun and shot at his colleague. 6 years later, Congressmember William J. Graves of Kentucky shot and killed Congressmember Jonathan Silley of Maine during a duel. And only a few decades ago, Senator Strom Thurmond wrestled a colleague to the floor. Well, all of these examples I'm reading from The Hill, which is a newspaper that covers Congress. And joining us right now to make sense of what the hell is going on up there is Marcia Gelbart, senior editor there.
I like to think of it as the O.J. case of the East.
So can you please explain what is happening?
Well, what I can do is update you on two things that happened yesterday. Let me back up for a second. Jim McDermott, who is the top-ranking Democrat on the panel, recused himself from any involvement in the Gingrich case. 2 days ago. And the reason that he did that is because there's so much controversy over what his particular involvement is with a tape that allegedly he received from a Florida couple, and the Florida couple intercepted this. They recorded a cellular phone conversation that the Speaker of the House was having with his top leadership aides. The controversy is that the focus became on Jim McDermott, the Democrat, and away from Speaker Newt Gingrich, the Republican under investigation. So he left the committee.
Leaving it for good or just this investigation?
He left the committee for this investigation, what's known as a recusal from the case. However, in effect, he's resigned. That's not the official terminology, and I want to be clear. But this committee will only meet until this Tuesday, and then new committee members will be appointed. And that's one point that really hasn't been brought out, period, is that, in effect, he has resigned. I mean, he's no longer going to do anything. His term is going to be up. Now, that left the committee, which had been composed of 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats, uneven. And this is one committee that, according to its own rules, has to have an even number from each party. Well, because it was left with 5 Republicans and 4 Democrats, yesterday a Republican agreed to recuse himself from the case.
Well, didn't Jim McDermott say he would actually not recuse himself unless he knew that it would be equal?
That is correct. So you can even argue that that Jim McDermott's recusal didn't even take effect until today. And we still haven't gotten an official word from him that he's going to
and
do
so
that.
And so who left?
A guy named Dave Hobson, who's a Republican from Ohio. He's a moderate. He also happens to be really close to the Speaker. He has spent the last 2 years in the 104th Congress sitting at the leadership table with the Speaker while at the same time on the Ethics Committee investigating him.
And he is not the newest member. That's who people thought would leave, is the person who just joined last
week.
That's
the big surprise. Last week, a guy named Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas, joined the committee to replace another Republican who left because he was just so sick up, so fed up with it, that he stepped down from the panel. And he was able to do that.
Now, what about Nancy Johnson? Nancy Johnson just barely survived her own race in Connecticut. And the reason she almost lost that race is the woman running against her for 2 years has been raising the issue of her ineptitude, or that was the best interpretation of what she's been doing as head of the House Ethics Committee. and yet, it seems that she has admired herself even further. What exactly is she doing? How is it possible that she unilaterally decided to cancel the hearings?
That's a question that nobody really knows the answer to. It appears that she broke House rules and the committee's rules, because you need a majority of the committee to make a decision like that, to cancel hearings and a schedule that had been agreed upon by all the committee members.
And that schedule would have meant that all this week we would have had public hearings.
It would have meant that you would have had public hearings beginning today, going Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, possibly. Now, we don't even know when public hearings are going to take place. The Washington Post this morning reported that there may be a single day of hearings. One day of hearings where they could have had up to 8 days.
What would this hearing be?
What this hearing would be is James Cole, who's the outside counsel who's been investigating the Speaker, would finally have a chance to present the facts of the case. A lot of the Republicans who voted for the Speaker to make him Speaker again the other week, they think that they knew enough about the case based, for one thing, on James Cole's initial report. However, the full report has never been completed, and that's what's due in today. You don't know what the knowledge, what the intent of the Speaker was. Both of those are critical elements that hopefully will be disclosed in this report.
He's going to hand it in today, but that doesn't mean it's made public now or ever.
I think it's going to be made public, but I think the committee members first need to read it and catch up on it so that they're ready to respond. Second, James Cole will testify at the public hearing, so the contents will in effect be made public.
Is it possible that there would be no hearing?
You know, at this point, I might say that it's quite possible there could be no hearing.
And what is that legal?
I think, of course, it's legal, because the committee, again, you have to go back to what the committee rules are. Did they agree to have a public hearing? They broke those laws. They're living by, they're making up the laws as they go along. Who knows?
What about what Newt Gingrich faces, with Jim McDermott entering the picture and leaving the picture because of what happened with the cellular phone conversation and his taking the tape. Well, it's not clear who exactly gave this to the New York Times, but there's discussion now on the Hill of a lighter penalty for Newt Gingrich.
There are a lot of Republicans who feel that, in effect, what the whole McDermott incident has done is demonstrated how partisan this process has been. And it's demonstrated how unserious, if I can make up that word for a second, the charges against the speaker are. And so they're saying, you know what, we're not even going to give him a reprimand. Even that is too much. Maybe what we'll do, we'll support a letter of reproval, which is basically a slap on the wrist. This is a far cry from what the Democrats wanted, which was a censure of the speaker. And, you know, one could argue that that is something they may still try to do on Tuesday. What's going to happen between now and then is that the committee itself will meet and vote on what kind of sanctions to bring against the speaker. Then the House will vote on the committee's recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going through the inauguration on Monday.
That's why, in effect, even if there are public hearings, there may not be any public hearings if nobody's going to watch them.
And what is your sense of where Democrats and Republicans stand on Newt Gingrich? I mean, in terms of practical politics, I've talked to a number of Congress members who basically say a weakened Gingrich is better than a strong army. right. His sidekick, who is really the person who runs the day-to-day operations, who would possibly be the one to replace him if Newt Gingrich went down. But there are others who have their own problems with the Ethics Committee, and so they don't want to open their mouths. What is the feeling right now?
Well,
on the Hill?
There are two levels here. One, how is the 105th Congress going to conduct itself? Will the speaker be the same type of speaker that he was in the 104th Congress? No way. He's already admitted to that. He hasn't given the committee chairman more power back.
Well, he's admitted to a lot of things.
He wouldn't talk to
the Congress members about, you know, what should happen. And now we see in this taped, whether it's illegal or not, conversation that he was clearly directing things from.
He was directing things, but it's still a gray area as to how serious that was. I mean, of course, you know, the Republicans argue, look, he's just arguing his defense. It wasn't really a breach of the law. Of the promise that he had made with the Ethics Committee. And Democrats say it was an outright breach of that promise. But in terms of how he'll conduct himself in the 105th Congress, he will be a less powerful, less influential speaker. And then the second level,
possibly even more vindictive because of what has happened.
I don't know if you'll see that because he's so... I don't know if he can be more vindictive. I think it might spread out maybe to the leadership, that maybe you'll see a more vindictive Dick Armey, who's the majority leader. Maybe you'll see a more vindictive John Boehner, who's the Republican conference chairman, and the same for the majority whip, Tom DeLay. We don't know how that will play out, but you have to remember, they've got a slimmer margin of control in that House. Hmm. So how vindictive they can be is really... Yeah, it's borderline.
What does this all mean for the House Ethics Committee and for the Ethics Committee in both houses?
Well, what it means is it really questions the ability of the House to police itself. Does the ethics process work? Where does it go from here? These are the questions that there's going to be a real stiff, hard examination of the process itself in the next couple of months.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Marcia Gilbert, senior editor of The Hill, a newspaper that specializes in covering Congress.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!
Dream of a seabird as it opens its wings to the gale. And as it soars o'er the island, it follows the wake of my trail. And when the dark night falls and the gray mists around me, my heart is a small...
A new film about the IRA hunger strikers is winning critical acclaim across the United States. It's also generating controversy across the Atlantic and Britain. Some British members of Parliament are calling for the film, Some Mother's Son, to be banned from theaters across Britain. And the film's lead actress, Helen Mirren, has been thrown off Britain's most popular television show. Today, we're pleased to be joined by director and co-writer Terry George. I just spoke with him. He was also the co-writer of In the Name of the Father, a film starring Daniel Day-Lewis about the wrongful imprisonment of four Irish men and women known as the Guildford Four. All were ultimately released from jail. Terry George, why don't you tell us, in Some Other Son, what this storyline is all about?
It's the story of two women, two Northern Ireland women, one middle class, a widowed schoolteacher called Kathleen Quigley, and that character is played by Helen Mirren, and a farmer's wife, a middle-aged, fairly poor, working-class farmer's wife, played by Fionnuala Flanagan. The character is called Annie Higgins, and Annie Higgins is a traditional Republican, a traditional supporter of Sinn Féin and the IRA, while Helen Mirren is a pacifist and trying to avoid and steer around the war in Northern Ireland. The film's set around 1979, 1981, and revolves around the involvement of these two women's sons in the war between the IRA, Sinn Féin, and the British. And what happens is that Helen Mirren discovers that her son has been involved in IRA activity, and subsequently he's arrested, sent to prison, along with Annie Higgins' son, called Frank Higgins, who's a leader in the IRA. Both sons are become part of what was then known as the Blanket Protest, a protest by IRA prisoners led by Bobby Sands for political recognition within the prison. This protest subsequently led to the hunger strike that Bobby Sands embarked on and was followed on by a number of his fellow prisoners. And the story is basically about the two women and how they cope with being dragged into this prison protest and what happens to their friendship and how they deal with ultimately the dilemma of both of their sons going on this hunger strike. And they finally face a crucial test of their love for their sons and their political beliefs, and that test revolves around the fact that at the time of the hunger strikes, when the hunger strikers lapsed into a coma, the British government and medical authorities pointed out that the families became the legal guardians and had the right to take their sons off the hunger strike, obviously by doing so possibly saving their lives, and in also doing so in wrecking the protest that the prisoners had embarked on. So it's a story of mothers in war and how they deal with their son's involvement in that war and how it impacts on their relationships and ultimately on their own humanity.
If you could just tell us what you mean by the men in blankets.
Well, the blanket protest arose out of the removal of prisoner of war status. The British government had granted IRA prisoners and prisoner of war status in 1972, whereby they lived by themselves outside the normal prison structures, and they wore their own clothes and they had their own command structure, very much like any prisoner of war movie we've seen in the past. Then the British government, the Labour government of 1975, took a decision to remove that political status, and then the Thatcher government, who were elected in 1978, took on that cause with a vengeance. And what they did was, any prisoner who arrived at the Mays prison was asked to put on a prison uniform and conform to the rules and to work. And ultimately, every IRA prisoner, or almost every IRA prisoner who arrived there, refused to put on the prison clothes, lived in a cell, dressed only in a blanket, and when the escalation of the protest happened, ultimately ended up smearing their own feces on the wall and pouring the urine out through the windows and under the doors in a head-on clash with the British government that resulted in the hunger strike.
Are you coming off the protest?
No, I'm not.
Well, what's going on?
We had to get word out about what's happened. They won't let us out to the toilets. start. We put it out the windows. Then they blocked up the windows, so we put it under the door. Then they blocked up under the door, so now we spread it on the walls.
Spread your dirt on the walls.
Well, what else can we do?
God, how can you live like this?
So that became known as the blanket protest.
And Terry George is director and co-writer of Some Mother's Son. That was an excerpt from the new movie that's airing in a few cities now. It'll open on January 31st. We'll continue our discussion with Terry George in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and again, we're joined by Terry George, director of Some Mother's Son. Terry, you had direct experience both with Mays Prison and the hunger strikers. Can you tell us about that?
First of all, in the very early 70s, in 1971-72, I was part of a sort of widespread swoop by the British Army against mostly the nationalist Catholic community, and I ended up interned for a short period of time, 6 weeks, in the Long Kesh, as the prison was then known. Afterwards, I became politically involved with various political groups in Northern Ireland, most of them nationalist and supporting the armed struggle. And in 1975, I was arrested as the driver of a car in which other people were carrying firearms, and I ended up in the Mays Prison, as it was then known. Its name changed quite often depending on who you spoke to and what their political affiliation was. The British government liked to call it the Mays Prison, and the nationalist community knew it as Long Kesh, and it had more of the connotation of a concentration camp or a prisoner of war camp. Anyway, I ended up in there for 3 years, from 1975 until 78. And while I was in there, as part of the Irish Republican Socialist Party faction, I got to know the various players in this political drama. Sands was across the prison football field from me in a cage, as they were called, these prison compounds opposite, and there were a few of the prisoners that in the compound that I was in who embarked on the hunger strike. One of them, Patsy O'Hara, ultimately died. So I knew the men involved in this, and I grew up in West Belfast. When I was released, I continued to live in West Belfast, and that was there all through the hunger strike period. So this is both a personal reflection on that period and the impact it had on all of the mothers that I knew, and it's also a universal story about how women and mothers in particular and parents cope with the actions of their children and where that leads them around the world.
Jared, a man was shot.
But he was a soldier.
He was somebody's son like your mine.
He was waiting to kill us. He got shot.
You lied to me.
I had to. I had to lie because I wanted to protect you.
Protect me?
I didn't think you could handle it. You spent years, like, running away from all this stuff, okay?
I'm your mother. Don't you talk to me about protecting me.
I'm sorry.
Sorry's not enough, Jared. Listen. I've got a lawyer downstairs, and he says that he could get your charge reduced to conspiracy.
I have to tell you something. I'm probably going to get locked up for a long time. And I don't need a lawyer. Because I'm a prisoner of war. I am not a criminal. I don't recognize the court.
Are you out of your mind?
No, I'm not out of my mind.
Time's up.
No, I haven't finished yet.
I'll be all right.
Look, I have to see him again. Jared, I'll be back.
Jared, this mother's son, eventually goes on hunger strike, and one of the most dramatic moments in the film is when the leader of the hunger strikers, the first to go on strike, Bobby Sands, actually runs for the British Parliament.
I mean, that was of any single event that changed the political course of Northern Ireland, I think it was that one election. And so I had to catch the sense there of the hope that gave to many people in the Catholic community who were opposed to the IRA and opposed to violence, because they felt that if they voted for Sands, it would show Margaret Thatcher that some in the Catholic community were interested in democracy, and it would also give her a way out, because once he was elected as MP, then they could negotiate with him MP to MP. Now, she refused to take that oblique way of resolving the conflict, but that was a unique experience for all of the Catholic community, and no one outside the Catholic community actually thought that he would get elected.
And the mother that Helen Mirren plays, it was the first time where she could see a real role for herself, because she too was always fighting the violence.
Exactly, and that was a mirror image of what took place at the time.
Listen, they're going to run Sands from Maguire's old seat in the British Parliament.
Fantastic idea.
Will you help us with the campaign?
Who do you mean by us?
You mean Sinn Féin?
No. Help the hunger strikers.
Annie, I don't believe in violence. You must understand that.
This isn't about violence, Mrs. Quigley. This is about elections.
Vote for Bobby Sands. It's a vote against British oppression in Ireland.
Vote for Bobby Sands.
Bobby Sands.
Bobby Sands. Hunger strikers.
There you go, Mrs.
Vote for Bobby Sands. Don't forget
Bobby Sands.
Call him.
Vote for Bobby Sands. Support the prisoners in their fight for political status.
We await the results of the Fermanagh South Tyrone by-election.
One of the most bitterly fought campaigns in Northern Ireland history.
We're going to go live as the polling officer approaches the microphone.
West Harold.
Unionist and Conservative Party of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
29,046.
Yeah!
Sir. Robert, anti-ITS bloc political prisoner. 30,000.
Yeah! I tried within this film to recreate the spirit and the thoughts of the people themselves. And because of that, sometimes a lot of the criticism has been about those actual recreations, the strident nature of the Thatcherite officials at the time, and how I've been accused of how I made the blanket protesters look Christ-like, whereas in fact, when you put someone in a blanket and they have a long beard and long hair, who else can they look like? They ain't going to look like Bill Clinton, you know?
How big was the funeral for Bobby Sands, the first hunger striker to die?
Well, the estimates, and you know, estimates of big crowds always vary according to who you ask, but the estimates range from 100,000 to 150,000, 200,000. And basically, it was all the adult population of West Belfast and a good deal of the nationalist community from around the suburbs and from further afield. So it was a massive crowd of 100,000, and our task was to try and recreate the sense of that. And what we did was ask people in the Dublin inner city, particularly community organisations and anti-drug organisations and so forth, to come out and support us. And we tried to make donations to the various committees and so forth, and we ended up getting about 5,000 people out and moving them around and using, you know, the tricks of cinema to show that crowd of 100,000.
How remembered are the 10 hunger strikers who died today?
Well, for the Catholic nationalist community in Ireland and in Northern Ireland, that was the seminal moment that defined the whole troubles for the last 30 years, because what it did was it evoked the legacy of the past of hunger strikers before Terence McSweeney and so forth in 1920 and 21, and at the same time it defined the battle with the British and the conflict with the British government as deeply political when they were trying to brand it as criminal.
Some 100,000 people took part in the funeral. Abroad, a wave of anti-British protests...
This is a disaster.
Is this the official Foreign Office line, or is this merely your line, Harry?
Thomas, do you know anything about the role of Irish martyrs in history? 1916, Pearse, Connolly. Well, you created another one.
...for Mrs. Thatcher to behave with compassion.
So it changed the whole nature of the struggle, and it also politicized Sinn Féin, and it was actually the seed of the peace process, because the secret negotiator who I show in the film, who was employed then to try and resolve the hunger strike, was reactivated in the early 90s and became the foundation for the peace process as it exists now. So everything that passed since 1981, you can trace back to the hunger strike. And, I mean, it symbolized the fact that this community basically wasn't going to be defeated. And I think had Thatcher had more foresight than she had, she could have moved on from that to set up some sort of system of negotiation that might have got us to some sort of conflict resolution today.
We're talking to Terry George, director of the new film Some Mother's Son. Terry, you just came back from Britain, where the film opened. What's been the response there?
Well, you know, first of all, we got off somewhat easier than I expected. Generally, the critical reviews about the film have been very strong, but the one character that seems to evoke a kind of paranoia and fear within the British film and the critical community and the wider newspaper community is the Thatcherite official that we have in the film, and I think they're to some degree they're embarrassed by the stridence and the sort of combative spirit that this character has within the film. But I actually used the words that the Thatcher officials spoke at the time.
The Prime Minister wants an entirely new approach to the Northern Ireland problem. We've drawn up a three-pronged strategy: isolation, criminalisation, demoralisation. We've cut off these routes across the border. We've taken control of these roads. We isolate the communities. Criminalisation. These people are criminals. They are not soldiers. They are not guerrillas. There is no war. There is only crime. Demoralization. I want to see these people in jail. We want to make the prisons an asset, not a liability. For it is in the prisons that we will break the back of the IRA.
When I tried to catch the sense of Margaret Thatcher herself, who at that time certainly wanted to be perceived as the Iron Lady and strong and determined and unflinching, particularly on this subject. The right-wing press were, you know, particularly abusive in that sort of unique Fleet Street tabloid way, about more about Helen Mirren than myself. I was written off as, you know, the terrorist, former terrorist, who was bringing his propaganda to the screen. Helen, because she's, I suppose, the grand dame of British theatre now, and certainly one of their foremost actors in the world, was heaped with ridicule about how silly she was, how she was, you know, prone to take her clothes off at the drop of a hat for any film, and, you know, her left-wing leanings and her cappuccino-drinking friends in Hollywood, and, it was like, you know, a deluge of verbal diarrhea.
Hasn't it been more than verbal abuse? Hasn't she been pulled from some shows that
Well, the BBC, that actually, the BBC asked our publicist there, would Helen consider? They approached her. Or, well, he might have approached them, and they agreed. For her to appear on the Lottery Show, which is the big late entertainment Saturday night show where a sort of cabaret show is built around the drawing of the lotto numbers in Britain. So Helen didn't want to do it because it's not her style, but she reluctantly agreed. And then when the review of the BBC chief film television reviewer, Barry Norman, came out, where basically he thought this was a pro-Sinn Féin, pro-IRA film, and that he didn't agree with its politics and condemned the film, they then disinvited her. So that's kind of typical of the nervousness that it happened before to Emma Thompson with In the Name of the Father. It sort of seems to be that they need to find their, you know, the English person who's the aspiring traitor. And the strange thing is that the films that were most, the newspapers that were most venomous about In the Name of the Father and how we had distorted the truth, etc., suddenly, with this film, started singing In the Name of the Father's praise and how this film had denigrated the wonderful, you know, drama of In the Name of the Father.
In the New York Times profile of you, Terry, in the last few weeks, they talked about how you and Helen Mirren battled throughout the film because of each of your politics. Can you talk about the differences there?
Yeah. Well, Helen is... she's left-wing humanist, and I guess her experience in Northern Ireland had been at the time when she lived with Liam Neeson. She visited there quite a lot, and she just felt that the IRA were, completely terrorist, and she felt like many British people feel that after, you know, numerous civilian bombings and killings in Britain, that they had no political agenda to offer, and I was trying to persuade her that it was much more complex than that. It didn't impact on the film. We just have these late night, you know, fairly heated discussions, which were good. I mean, we dealt on a much more personal level than most people do, director, movie stars do. So I enjoyed it a lot, and I think she got a lot out of it. But
in fact, the character really represents that point of view that Helen plays.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I respected her point of view. It has a great deal of legitimacy. I mean, we started off doing this film in the middle of the ceasefire, and then as I was editing it after the Canary Wharf explosion, and particularly the Manchester explosion, you know, the whole thing fell apart, and it was a deeply depressing time for me, you know, because I thought we'd gone beyond that and beyond the car bombs and the return to the violence. And I'd just come back from Belfast a few days ago, and the level of depression there is almost palpable. You can almost cut it with a knife.
What could the British and the IRA do right now that could lead to a meaningful peace and ultimately a referendum?
Well, first of all, the British did erect conditions after the ceasefire was declared that they didn't state at the table beforehand. So there's a great deal of disingenuous talk by the major government, were they erected barriers to Sinn Féin's entry into these talks that were unpalatable to Sinn Féin and to all the nationalist community. I mean, it's a ridiculous notion to talk about this decommissioning of arms before any settlement has been agreed on, and I think around the world everyone recognises that. So there should be talks without preconditions. What have we to lose? It's either talks or no talks. That seems perfectly clear and a very easy call to me. Allow Sinn Féin into the talks. And Sinn Féin and the IRA side, they seem to be, they're reactive all the time. They're forced to act upon whatever the British government decides, which is a very strange position to be in for a revolutionary movement. I think they had to take the initiative and call a ceasefire and then let the onus on be put once more on the British government. I don't see going back to the war is going to gain them anything.
Terry George, I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning to talk about your film, Some Other Son, and Irish politics in general. This is the kind of movie that Hollywood should be making every day.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Some Other Son is airing in 9 cities now, including San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle, and New York. It opens nationwide on January 31st. Up next, Bernadette McCaskey. She'll be talking about her daughter. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can order it by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now! From one mother's son to one mother's daughter, Irish civil rights leader Bernadette Devlin McCaskey's 25-year-old pregnant daughter sits in an isolated, high-security prison in London, England. She's awaiting extradition to Germany on charges she attempted to murder 150 British soldiers as part of an IRA commando operation last year. We're now joined by two people, Bernadette Devlin McCaskey, Irish nationalist from the north of Ireland. We're speaking to her there. She led the struggle in the 60s and 70s for civil rights of Northern Ireland's poor Catholic communities and has been an outspoken leader of the Republican movement, was the youngest member to serve in the British Parliament. Jerry McGough also joins us from Ireland. He's an Irish nationalist who spent 4 years in German prisons. Bernadette, we were just testing your phones and they sound terrible. Is there any way you can go on to another phone?
No, I think my line's fuzzy because the police are currently on it as well. They wouldn't mind shifting their asses just for half an hour.
Okay. It'll just have to do. What is the situation with your daughter?
Well, the situation from the beginning is that the German authorities have requested her extradition to Germany on what they say is a strong suspicion that she was involved in the bombing of a British Army base in Osnabrück, and they wish to charge her with attempted murder of 150 persons, being British soldiers on the base at that time. She was originally arrested on the 20th of November, and under the emergency legislation of the North. And she was held and interrogated for a period of 6 days, at the end of which, having threatened to extradite her to Germany if she didn't cooperate with the authorities, they did produce a request from Germany. On the foot of that request, she was further held in custody and moved from Northern Ireland to London, where she was taken to Holloway Women's Prison. Then, because of the seriousness of the charges, the Home Office designated her a high-risk Category A security prisoner. And Holloway Women's Prison was deemed not to be secure enough for her, and on the orders of the Home Office, she was moved to an all-male prison, where she became the only and the first woman ever to be incarcerated in Belmarsh High Security All-Male Prison. She has now been in continual custody since November 20th, on the basis of this request from Germany that she be sent there to stand trial. She's a young woman of 25, a frail young person in not very good health throughout her life, but had been in particularly ill health, which was complicated by her pregnancy. She is now 6 months pregnant. We, to update the situation, only discovered, courtesy of a delegation that our American friends, Pat Gatens, organized a delegation to the German consul or embassy in Washington and met with a German consular official there. And when they asked him how he would feel if a young German woman was held in those conditions in Germany at the request of a foreign power who had not produced any real evidence, he said that would never happen because Germany refuses to extradite its citizens under any circumstances. So having checked that that information was correct, we are at this point astounded at the arrogance of the Germans, who are using the European Extradition Treaty to attempt to extradite Roisin to Germany, when in actual fact they derogated from that part of the treaty, refusing to extradite any of their own citizens. And just today, an Irish citizen in Dublin was released on the order of the Minister of Justice there because Germany, according to the law in Ireland, has no right to seek the extradition of the national of another country from their own government when they have actually refused to participate in that part of the treaty themselves. So it looks like my daughter, at this point, we are going to the High Court in London on this matter tomorrow. And at this point, it looks like my daughter has been held in the most horrendous prison conditions of isolation, lack of daylight, lack of exercise, lack of association, lack of medical care. Since the 20th of November, when the Germans knew they had no right to extradite her at all.
What evidence does the British government say it has to implicate Roisin in the bombing?
The British government has no evidence, nor does the British government require evidence. Under the European Extradition Treaty, the British government only requires a request from another European country to extradite, and they are not, under the European Treaty, required to produce a prima facie case. The procedure is fairly straightforward and undemocratic. The country, in this case Germany, simply requests that a person be detained because they wish to extradite them. That person is provisionally arrested and can be held in custody until the documentation supporting the request comes from Germany. The law asks that it be forwarded within 18 days, but if the country fails to forward it within 40 days, the person then is allowed to go free. Now, the Germans did not come forward until the 40th day, which was the very last opportunity, with papers regarding Roisin. And in those papers, they came forward with only two points of evidence in relation to Roisin, which one of which is her fingerprints on a snippet of cellophane, which is believed to be the upper part of the wrapping that goes around a packet of cigarettes. And the other point of evidence was that a landlord of a holiday home some 70 miles from Osnabrück was shown on November the 26th a photograph of Roisin taken by the police when she was being held in the interrogation centre in the north of Ireland. And it was suggested to him that this was the young woman he had seen, and he agreed. Now, that procedure of what's called suggestive identification would rule that witness's testimony out of court in a British or Irish court. And that's the sum total of the evidence on which the Germans have asked that my daughter stand trial in Germany for attempted murder of 150 persons.
We're talking to Bernadette Michalski, and her daughter Roisin is in a cell. She is 5 months pregnant. We're also joined on the phone by Jerry McGough, who is an Irish nationalist who spent a number of years in a German prison. Jerry, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what are the conditions in the German prisons, and also why were you there?
Well, the conditions leave a lot to be desired from my own personal experiences. I was arrested in August of 1988, along with another Irish fellow compatriot, and we were the first Irish Republicans to have ever been incarcerated by the Germans on foot of charges relating to an Irish Republican campaign against the British military on the European continent at that time.
Were you IRA?
This is what the Germans were alleging. And Bernadette pointed out earlier about the lack of evidence that they required. And what I discovered painfully in the course of my time of incarceration there is that the Germans do not need any hard evidence per se. All that they require under their law is the suspicion. That's sufficient to keep a person held on remand or without trial under such time as they can put together what they consider to be enough evidence to go to trial. So myself and my compatriot, we were held for some 2 years on remand before we were eventually brought to trial in 1990, a trial which incidentally itself lasted some 2 years. And in the course of the period on remand, the mere suspicion of involvement in various attacks and so forth was all that the Germans needed to continually remand us every 6 weeks or every 3 months or whatever it was. They would impose what they call a Haftbefehl or an arrest warrant. And when the actual trial came about, we discovered that the evidence, such as it was really ludicrous. And a lot of it was based on what Bernd has referred to, eyewitnesses and so on and so forth. And these were eventually all discredited in the course of what was a horrendous two-year trial itself, which was conducted in an underground bunker designed to withstand a military assault. The conditions which I endured throughout those 4 years, and in particular during the first part of my time there, were really quite horrendous. And the German prosecutor at the time of our arrest said that he would break me within a matter of a few weeks. And as a consequence, they put me in a prison in Rheinland-Pfalz, which was then southwest of Germany. And it was actually built and designed to hold German political prisoners from the 1970s. And it was also constructed in order to break the human spirit. And most of the emphasis was put upon isolation, keeping the prisoner completely in the dark, and sometimes quite literally in the dark, and away from friends and relatives and from other prisoners, so that he or she hadn't a clue as to what was going on around them. And also keep in mind that in our trial, the Germans used some 13 agencies, international secret service agencies, ranging from the Scandinavian countries through to the Middle East, to Australia and the United States and so forth. So one can't begin to imagine just how Kafkaesque this whole thing was. Mm. And my heart really goes out to Roisin and any other Irish people who are facing potential processes over there. And bear in mind also that the Germans, as I say, they're usually not overly impressed by humanitarian issues, and we found this to our cost. There were several international human and civil rights groups who were very concerned, to say the least, about the conditions under which we were being held, but it didn't really, in fact, it didn't have any effect whatsoever upon the Germans.
Let me ask Roisin's mother, Bernadette Devlin Michalski, If you think that the arrest of your daughter, it shows a hardening of the British stance toward the peace process.
Well, I mean, I have argued consistently that peace process is a misnomer for the process upon which the British government systematically embarked from a number of years ago. And I think to go for my daughter, who, because of my own activity and my own profile, was a very high-profile person, I think it's a very clear message on the part of the British that they can do what they like and the community can do very little about it. And I think this has been an attempt by their part to flex their military and authoritarian muscles.
Let me ask each of you, listeners around the country are listening to this program, if they're interested in somehow intervening, if they're interested in somehow helping, what can they do? Bernadette, what do you think they can do? And Jerry, what helped you when you were in a German prison?
Well, if I might say very simply, if people are listening, a very simple, straightforward thing they can do is they can ring the German embassy in Washington. Let me give you a number for that. It's area code 202-298-4000.
That's 202-298-4000?
Yep. And they can ask the German embassy there, A, is it true that Germany will not extradite its own citizens for any reason whatsoever? And if so, then with what arrogance have they demanded the extradition of my daughter on evidence that would not pass committal hearing and demand her immediate release?
Bernadette Michalski, if the Germans drop their extradition request, will the British release Roisin from jail?
Yes, the British have no reason to hold Roisin. She has simply been held at the request of the German authorities. Initially, I think the thing to do is to keep bombarding the German embassy. If people want to write at this point to Roisin herself, let me give you her prison number. That's Roisin Michalski, T for Tommy, G for George, 2456 Holloway Prison, London, M7, England. And
let me just repeat that.
Yep.
That's Roisin Michalski, TG2456 Holloway Prison, London, N as in Nancy, 7.
Yep.
Britain. What is the course of things now?
Now, the normal course of things at this point is we go to the court today. An extradition, a date for the extradition hearing will be set. Then we move from there to, that's probably a two-day hearing. The Home Office will probably order her extradition, and then we go to the High Court to appeal.
Let me just ask finally, Bernadette, since this line is not a great one, and you were saying you think it's because the British are listening, how do you know that they tap your phone?
Well, one of the things they said to my daughter when she was being interrogated in the interrogation center was that they had broken into her flat and bugged it, and that they had been listening to her personal conversations in her flat, and they had been listening to her conversations on the telephone for 2.5 years. She was able, because of personal details she had given them, to take it as read they were telling her the truth. Now, the police, when they arrested my daughter and raided her home, they used that as an excuse to raid my own home. And as I say, they removed all my political work, which they still hold. And I'm sure that they took the opportunity of their presence in my house to do the same sort of stuff here.
Bernadette?
Not, I mean, it's an inconvenience. I don't care if they are listening. They hear my opinion of them more regularly then than they would if they weren't.
Bernadette Devlin-McAliskey, thank you so much for joining us. We've also been joined by Jerry McGow, an Irish nationalist. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland, executive producer Julie Jerzin, our engineer Kenneth Mason, with help from Joe Gill. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!